This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. What can we learn about past environmental practices from two 19th century Nantucket castaways who spent years trading sea cucumbers and sperm whale teeth around the Pacific? Personally, I have little to no idea, but I'd like to know. And my guest today is coincidentally writing a book on exactly that topic. So he's the guy to ask. Ted Melillo is Associate Professor of Global Environmental History at Amherst College, where he teaches courses on global environmental history, particularly the Pacific world, and commodities in world historical perspective. Ted Melillo, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me.
Ted, if anyone could possibly have a genetic predisposition to their career, it's you. Your father is Jerry Melillo, well-known environmental scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory. Your mother's a historian, runs the history department at Falmouth Academy. Was there ever a point in your life where you thought you would be anything other than an environmental historian?
Probably not. I mean, I really do feel like I came into this genetically, as you suggested. My dad is an ecologist. My mom is a history teacher. And so the two never seemed to be that far apart for me. It always seemed like the dinner table was a place where this interdisciplinary conversation was ongoing. And Shakespeare and the nitrogen cycle were never far apart.
Okay, that one you've got to explain. How do you get from Shakespeare to the nitrogen cycle?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit more about guano maybe later in the interview if we get into that. But it turns out that bird poop was a major ingredient from the 1700s through the 19th century in promoting agricultural fertility throughout the world. And Shakespeare could not have written his great works without having eaten.
All right. So that's what you're talking about around the dinner table. I can see where your career came from. Now, in high school, you earned an international baccalaureate degree from, is this Armand Hammer?
Armand Hammer.
Which becomes Armand Hammer, the company at some point. Right. Anyway, from the United World College of the American West. So why go that extra step? I mean, you're already getting, you know, your degree from Falmouth Academy.
Right.
What was that about?
So it's an international school. It's one of 14 schools around the world that are built on a curriculum of peace and international understanding. And you take the International Baccalaureate. And for U.S. students, you go in your senior year of high school and then 1 year after that. And I had a friend who went. I went out and visited and was just blown away by how fabulous this program is because it brings together 200 students from over 60 countries for 2 years. And you get to experience their cultures and their backgrounds, and it's just a fabulous program. So I decided to forgo my senior year at Falmouth Academy and go out to New Mexico. And then after my 2 years at that school and attending college at Swarthmore, I went and taught at the United World College in Norway and had another fabulous experience there.
What did you take away both from the student experience and the teaching experience going into your career in environmental history, working a lot with international trade in the research that you do? How did that influence you?
Well, just the cultural diversity of these programs is remarkable. And I think I really came to understand the world as a much more complicated and nuanced place than when I had originally gone. And I was exposed to different foods, languages, approaches to thinking that I think radically altered my approach to studying world history. That's just the take home for me was that the world is a really complex place, but it can be understood if you're willing to take on those challenges. So.
Now, you mentioned you went to Swarthmore, then Yale for graduate work, and wrote your thesis on the long-term cultural and ecological connections between Chile and California.
Does this
get us to the guano story? I mean, because I think Chile and California in one sentence, and the only thing that comes to mind for me is white wine.
Right. And wine is certainly a part of the book. This is my forthcoming book called Strangers on Familiar Soil, and it's coming out with Yale University Press in November. And it's on 222 years of ecological and cultural exchange between Chile and California, which really gets going in 1786 when a French explorer named La Perouse brings the potato from the Andes to California and gives it as a gift to the mission at Carmel. And the friars there plant it, the Franciscans there plant it, and then local Indian communities, Ohlone communities, actually incorporate the potato into their foodways. And then the book extends all the way out to 2008, when Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, visited California and had a series of exchanges with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was then governor of the state. And Schwarzenegger, of course, Hollywood star and former bodybuilder, pictured next to this 5'2", 5'3" president of Chile, who's a quite amazing woman, turned out to just be such an incredible moment in world history that I had to use it as the bookend to the story. So, and it gets us to the guano story in some ways, although guano comes from the Chincha Islands off the coast of Peru, and it's really a Peruvian component in the large world fertilizer trade. The big sodium, the big ingredient for Chile to California is sodium nitrate, which is a fertilizer that's mined from the Atacama Desert, the driest place in the world in northern Chile. And the guano era, which spans from 1840 to 1870, is based on bird poop. And then the era that follows on from that is based on Chilean sodium nitrate, which provided this infusion of fertility to California's orange growers through the 1930s, and turns out to be one of the really most important ingredients at the end of the agricultural revolution of the late 19th century.
How did you first get interested or introduced to this topic, this connection between California and Chile?
Right. So I started graduate school as a Chinese historian, and I was working on Chinese history, and then for a number of reasons decided I didn't want to learn all the languages required to be able to do Chinese history, and I crossed the Pacific and started working on the other places that begin with the letter C, Chile and California. So that was the rubric under which my work became jokingly grouped by my peers in graduate school. And I got interested in the Chile-California connection because I began thinking about why it was that at the grocery store, depending on the season, all our food comes from either one or two of those places, either from California or from Chile. And there's a counter-seasonal production cycle around which the world's grocery stores essentially operate. Half the year, the growing season in the southern hemisphere produces all the fruit and vegetables we eat, and then the other half of the year, it's the northern hemisphere. And I began to wonder about how this had come to be, and it led me down this road towards studying globalization, and the connections between Chile and California turned out to be one really informative window into that. So that's how I ended up initially with the topic. And then as I dug further, I guess to use the appropriate metaphor, I realized that during the California Gold Rush, this was a major period of Chilean influence on the state's development because 8,000 Chileans showed up during the Gold Rush to mine gold. And the first prostitutes who arrived in San Francisco were from Chile, and I follow their stories. And many of the early miners that showed up during the Gold Rush in 1849 were from Chile. And it turns out they built this really durable array of communities in California. There was an early Chilean newspaper in San Francisco called La Voz de Chile, the Voice of Chile. And then the influences just carry on and on and on. And for example, alfalfa comes to California from Chile and then subsidizes what becomes the United States' leading dairy industry because all of California's cattle are consuming Chilean alfalfa. And then it turns out that this sodium nitrate fertilizer becomes really crucial to supporting the California orange boom, which is the next wave of the state's agricultural growth. So one of the theses of this book is without these crucial Chilean ingredients, you wouldn't have a California that you have today.
That is an incredible array of environmental and economic and cultural stories that all came out of a casual observation at the grocery store. I love that.
That's where it usually begins for me, is in these casual observations that when you start to pick them apart and realize these givens, these basic assumptions that we all take for granted, have thick, deep histories. And that's what really fascinates me both about my research and my teaching, is taking those basic assumptions and beginning to pick them apart and figure out the depth of things behind them.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with environmental historian Ted Melillo. Ted, we're used to thinking of commodities. When we hear the word commodity, it's, you know, an economic report that's coming out and it's the price of oil or the price of milk, and we're using it as an economic indicator. But a lot of your research uses commodities as a way to dig into social and environmental issues. So how does that work? What do you get out of commodities that you might not get out of something else as a data source?
So I'm currently teaching a class that I call Commodities, Nature, and Society, and it's taken me years to put this together, but we've studied in the past silver, silk, coffee, tea, tobacco, sneakers, microchips, units of bandwidth, human body parts, things that are put into the market for exchange but serve as ciphers that we can then follow through a global system to pick apart the social relations that are really undergirding the production, the distribution, and the consumption of these products. And it turns out that globalization has provided us remarkable insights into the ways the world works, but it's also mystified a lot of the processes and the labor that's gone into the making of many commonplace products. And I begin the whole class by taking apart an iPhone. And the students and I look at all the ingredients that go into the production of this rather quotidian item at this point. And you start to figure out that there may be up to 60 countries and many different environments and landscapes involved in the accretion of all these materials that go into your iPhone. There may be copper mined in Chile. There may be coltan mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The circuit boards may have been put together in Korea or India, and then parts of the assembly are done in China, parts are done in Germany. And then after you buy the iPhone, there's a support system that's based on call centers in the Philippines. And so the world is coming together and accreting into this item that seems so commonplace to us, but yet to pick apart all the environments, people, and processes involved in bringing that thing together gives us a new window into both the present and the past.
I was looking through that list of the nine different commodities that you cover in one of your courses and starting to think about this. And I realized, you know, for me, what it kind of brought up are a couple of books that Mark Kurlansky wrote. The first was just called Cod.
Right.
Right. And it's a history of cod. And I remember seeing an interview with him after that book came out and his next book was Salt. And somebody said, well, how'd you get to salt? And he said, oh, well, once you're studying the history of cod, you can't help but start studying the history of salt because they were so intertwined to make salt cod. And then a few years later, there were a few books that came out on the history of milk. And I remember joking, oh, well, you know, all we need now is the history of potatoes and we've got the history of chowder.
Right.
But, you know, you can see how these are really commonplace items and start to connect these global themes and bigger environmental issues to our everyday life in a really hard-hitting way.
Absolutely. And some of these books make fairly grandiose claims how bouillabaisse changed world history or whatever the particular commodity you're studying is. And I'm skeptical of those. And I'm also skeptical of the types of books that basically are sort of a Google search approach to doing commodity history, where all they're doing is compiling all of the information they can find on one particular product and then giving it to you inside two book covers. And some of those are real problems. But what I'm much more interested in is moving away from the thing in and of itself and moving towards the social relations and the environmental relations that undergird its production and its consumption. And as you're saying, there really are cascade effects here. Once you start studying sugar and you get into the plantation agriculture and the slavery involved, it's hard to not then move on to cotton and think about the parallels there. It's another commodity that relied upon massive amounts of slave labor and environmental degradation in the world's tropics. And then you begin to build on these themes, and these themes become the centerpiece of the research and the teaching rather than just focusing on the things in and of themselves. And I think that revelation for students is an exciting one because they begin to see, wow, actually studying history is not just a dress rehearsal for the present. We can really learn about dynamics that underwrite the making of our world.
Where is the environmental piece in what you're doing? A lot of what you're talking about and referencing sounds very much like it's still economic history or social history, slavery. And obviously, you know, there's got to be an environmental side to growing a crop. But how much of what you're doing is more perhaps in the traditional history bin, and how much of it is really more toward the environmental science side of things?
Yeah, so the traditional history bin has been much more focused on the global divisions of labor that underwrite the production of these commodities. And I spend a lot of my time in my research and coursework thinking about global divisions of nature that are also present at every turn in the production of the commodities that are traded and exchanged globally. And so I'm looking at things like, for example, to produce that iPhone, there have been major environmental consequences globally for places as far-reaching as Chile and the Democratic Republic of Congo, two of which I mentioned earlier. And so the effects on our global environment of commodity production are often not looked at. And the attempt here is to bring that together with more traditional economic history and say, well, without understanding the environmental part of these processes, we really don't have a full sense of what's going on here.
You mentioned earlier human body parts in your list, mm-hmm. and I let it slide for a few minutes, but what's the environmental connection to the international trade of human body parts?
So, well, one of the things we study actually in the course is body part tourism, where people travel long distances at immense carbon footprints often to get body parts replaced. And in the global kidney trade and the cornea trade, this is one of the things that's going on. And students actually even look into the carbon footprint of flying millions of people across the globe to get body parts replaced. And the reason this isn't done in your hometown hospital is because it's based on a smuggling network of illicit interactions. And so the geography of the human body parts trade actually has an environmental footprint that can be measured. And it's a displaced kind of commodity where it's not occurring around the corner. It's requiring a new type of tourism, in fact. And it's a quite deadly type of tourism because it's predicated on often illegal operations in which people are giving up a kidney and selling it onto this market that then people are traveling from long distances away to get implanted. And the regulations of this are almost non-existent. And so one can look at the environmental footprint of this trade and actually measure the amount of carbon being emitted into the atmosphere by millions of people traveling around the world to get body parts replaced. And so it's a quite odd and disturbing at times topic of study, but is really important.
That's environmental historian Ted Melillo. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk about Ted's upcoming book about Nantucket and the Pacific world after a short break. Stay with us. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Ted Melillo. He's Associate Professor of Global Environmental History at Amherst College and author of an upcoming book entitled Out of the Blue, Nantucket and the Pacific World. Ted, we talked a little bit about guano. We talked about a number of these other commodities that you teach about. One that hasn't cropped up yet, which I think is the top commodity that we hear about today, is oil.
Mm-hmm.
So what about oil? Why isn't that on your list and something that you teach your students about?
Because I think there's so much work on oil going on right now that students tend to have encountered it or experienced it, whether it's an economics course, a course on energy, courses in the environmental studies program. Oil is one that's so commonplace both in our world and in our curriculums that the commodities I tend to study are ones that may give us different angles, especially on the sort of cultural anthropological side of studying commodities, where I don't think oil is as interesting as something like chocolate. Chocolate's one of the commodities that I'm working with in my course this year. And one of the fascinating aspects of thinking about cacao, the bean from which chocolate comes, is its transition across the Atlantic Ocean. It's domesticated in the Americas and is widely cultivated throughout Mesoamerica by groups like the Mayan and Aztec peoples. And then it makes a journey, both physically and culturally, across the Atlantic to Europe, to the Iberian Peninsula, and is integrated in various ways into European society in ways that change both its physical consumption. The Aztecs drank it as a bitter beverage, often with chiles, and it was a spicy, hot beverage. And in Europe, it gets sweetened. And it also gets secularized. The religious connotations that chocolate consumption had in the Americas get purged gradually in Europe. And I'm really interested in cultural processes that work themselves out geographically. And with oil, it has a fascinating history, of course, but you can't really get into the cultural anthropological processes that underwrite its movements. And so I tend to focus on commodities that allow us to think that way.
I read that you have given talks about insect-based commodities and the way that they have shaped world history.
Right.
Silk, I guess, is an insect-based commodity. Are there others?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, of course, honey is one we all think about.
Oh, yeah.
But shellac, it turns out that all the original records people listened to, they were made out of shellac, is the extrusion from an insect that lives on fig trees in northern India and Thailand. And the other big insect commodity traded in world history is cochineal, which is a red dye made from the crushed female bodies of an insect that grows in the Americas on nopal cacti. And it was the second most traded commodity in the Spanish Empire, only after silver. And the
that
Spanish
seems very
were after
obscure to be the second most traded
it
commodity.
It does, but Europe wanted a source of red dye. And the red dyes used throughout Europe were mostly plant-based dyes before the conquistadors arrived in the Americas in the 1500s. And those dyes didn't have the deep red and the fixative properties that cochineal had. And if you're a religious leader or a political leader, red is the symbol of sangre, of blood, and of leadership. And so having clothing that's dyed red turns out to be really important if you're an elite. And so getting access to a source of red dye becomes a preoccupation of the Spanish. And it turns out that cultivators in the Americas had been raising these little female insects for their red dye for thousands of years. And so the Spanish colonized this process and then rely upon it for all of their red dye. And it takes 70,000 of these little bugs crushed up to make a 1-pound brick of cochineal. And millions of these bricks traveled by ship across the Atlantic to Spain. And so this is one of the great insect commodity stories in world history, because it turns out we're still eating a lot of this stuff. There was a revelation in the 60s and 70s that a lot of the synthetic dyes that we come up with to put in our food are carcinogens. And so there was a search to figure out a natural product to which we could return as a substitute in our food to dye things red. And so when you drink Campari or you eat Danone fruit on the bottom yogurt, or you drink a strawberry frappuccino from Starbucks, you're actually consuming a female insect body that was probably cultivated in southern Mexico or Peru. And that's the stuff called carmine. So next time you're looking at an ingredients list, if you see carmine, it's likely that you're consuming an insect product.
I think you have just put a huge number of people off of their breakfast snacks.
I hope I'm not going to get sued by Starbucks after this, but... there was a big uproar by vegans. I don't know how many vegans were actually drinking strawberry frappuccinos from Starbucks, but we were very upset that there was technically an insect product in these frappuccinos from one of the leading coffee chains in the world. So this stuff is now ubiquitous once again, because we've had this turn away from synthetic products back towards natural products, and cochineal is one of those.
So you have to choose the lesser of the two evils, the artificial color or the squished bug.
Exactly. And the squished bug has made a real resurgence. So this work that I've done has focused on silk and shellac and cochineal in world history.
Fascinating. I want to get to your upcoming book about Nantucket and the Pacific world. A couple of commodities that feature in that. The first one being sea cucumbers. Mm-hmm. So why were sea cucumbers being traded internationally in the 19th century?
Right. That's a very good question. It turns out that sea cucumbers, since the 14th century in China, have been not only a culinary delicacy, but are really important in Chinese medicine. And they're used for treating all sorts of ailments, from constipation to kidney ailments. They're a treatment for impotence. They're a sexual stimulant. And so the Chinese have always been great consumers of sea cucumbers. And a number of New Englanders figured this out in the 19th century and literally built their fortunes trading sea cucumbers from places like Hawaii and later Fiji to China. And they became the intermediaries in this global flow of commodities, in this case the sea cucumber, towards the Chinese market. And more historians have been looking at world history and seeing China as the real driver for the development of globalization into the 19th century. We used to think it was Europe that was sort of the sink, the center of the world economy, but really Chinese demand is increasingly understood as the driver for globalization early on. And so these two Nantucketers whose stories I've been following, David Whippy and William Carey, ended up as castaways in the 1820s in Fiji. And they then sort of figured out that organizing the sea cucumber trade made a lot of sense economically for them. And so they acted as translators and cultural emissaries for arriving New England ships that were taking sea cucumbers to China. And these New Englanders were mostly Salem captains. And basically the fortunes of downtown Salem were built on the sea cucumber trade. And if you actually go and visit Salem, many of the mansions were built on money that was profit from this trade. So the sea cucumber
has... Do you think most people know that?
I think probably not. So I'm hoping probably not. And this will be one of the chapters in the forthcoming book.
Is that trade still going on? I heard something the other day about the fact that there are multiple species of sea cucumbers that are either endangered or they're trying to get listed as endangered because of over-harvesting.
The trade is still going on, and in fact, it's a $3 million a year trade from Fiji to China still. And it doesn't really benefit many Fijians because the trickle down of the economic value from the extraction to the sale of these products in China is very low for common folk in Fiji. But it's a very profitable trade for the middlemen who are taking the sea cucumbers to China and then selling them there. But my dad and I traveled in China twice, and one of the times we ate this famous soup called Buddha Jumps Over the Wall, which is a Fujianese soup named after the supposed fact, this may be apocryphal, but that the aromas of the soup were so delicious that vegetarian Buddhist monks would leap over the walls of their monasteries to get a taste of this soup.
So maybe no frappuccinos with insects in them, but they were going to go for the sea cucumbers.
With insects, but certainly sea cucumbers. And so the sea cucumber trade is extremely profitable from the 1820s on, and these two Nantucketers figured out how to insinuate themselves into this trade as these organizers of labor recruitment and these cultural emissaries, as go-betweens between Fijian chiefs and these arriving New England traders. And so what I follow in this particular chapter of the book is their two parallel biographies, William Carey and David Whippy, but I also do social biographies of the sea cucumber and the sperm whale's tooth, which was the other thing that Whippy and Carey figured out they could trade in.
So explain that trade.
Right. So that trade is parallel in some ways in that the sperm whale's tooth has also very different value across cultural boundaries. So in Fiji, a sperm whale's tooth is regarded as sacred and is called a tambua. And tambua are negotiators of social debt. They're things that you'd give at times of social union, like marriages or other social ceremonies. And it's a route through an object to the divine. And Carey and Whippy began to figure this out. But it turns out that whale's teeth also were a common ingredient aboard ships that were traveling to the Pacific, because whalers ended up with a whole bunch of sperm whale's teeth after they killed a sperm whale. And those were thought to have very little value until some sailors with a lot of time on their hands started to carve on those whale's teeth. And they became what we call scrimshanders. And this is scrimshaw. And so for Nantucketers and New Englanders, the whale's tooth only acquires value when it has carving on it. But for Fijians, it only has value when it's free of carving, because a tambua that's been carved or dyed with black dye has no more value on it. One of the things I'm exploring in this work is the ways that things change value as they cross cultural boundaries. And I call this encounters of value. The sea cucumber for Fijians is just kind of a supplementary ingredient to an already tremendously varied diet. But for the Chinese, it's considered a wellspring of health and a key culinary ingredient. For many New Englanders, they were repulsed by the sea cucumber and thought it was absolutely gross that anyone would ever deign to eat these things. And so as we cross cultural boundaries, we often see shifts in value. And I use the sea cucumber and the whale's tooth as ways to investigate this.
Sounds like David Whippy and William Carey were pretty open-minded and entrepreneurial for the time, really, to come over there. How did they even get to Fiji in the first place? Were they whalers or fishermen?
Right. So Whippy had been working aboard a whale ship but was a castaway. His captain, Peter Dillon, on the brig Calder, had left him in 1824 in Fiji to gather a cargo of sandalwood, tortoise shell, and mother of pearl for sale in China. Again, these are New England merchants who are trying to figure out the Chinese market, because there's this vast market just awaiting potential supply. And the captain never came back for Whippy. He didn't come back for 10 years, in fact. And so Whippy ended up as a castaway in Fiji and had to make his way. And he becomes kind of a soldier in arms for Fijian chieftains, because the other thing that New Englanders and others were bringing to Fiji were guns. And between the 1820s and the 1830s, there are about 5,000 muskets delivered to Fijians that become really important in the internecine warfare that's characterizing Fiji in this period. There are two great Fijian kingdoms that are fighting it out, Rewa and Mbao. Mbao is a seaborne kingdom in which the warriors float on these giant double-hulled canoes, and Rewa is a land-based kingdom. One anthropologist has actually joked that this was kind of the Peloponnesian Wars of the Pacific. And Rewa and Mbao are going at each other for 12 years, and people like Carey and Whippy become mercenaries as well as entrepreneurs in these battles. And they actually are involved in a number of massacres that they write about quite freely. And so they're their tale is one of woe as well as one of excitement at finding these new markets. But Carey actually ends up in Fiji the following year. His boat, the aptly named Oh No, gets in a shipwreck on a southern Fijian island. Fiji, by the way, is an archipelago of 332 islands in the South Pacific. And his boat crashes on one of these islands, and a group of warriors from a Fijian island kill all of the crew from this boat except for Carey, because he's hiding out under a rock along the shore. And he spends two nights under this rock in a little cave. And then a very compassionate local headman finds him and takes him into his village. And then Carey and Whippy suddenly meet up. Their two canoes happen to meet on the shore off of one of these Fijian islands. And they're just shocked that these two kids who knew each other on Nantucket have ended up as castaways in Fiji. And their story unfolds as a kind of parallel biography to the social biographies that I'm doing of the sea cucumber and the whale's tooth.
What kinds of records do we have of these two people? How do you get to that level of detail about their lives in the Pacific at this point in history?
Fortunately, they wrote a lot. And all of Carey's writings got published by the Nantucket Mirror and Inquirer as a book when he came back after 9 years in Fiji to Nantucket. But we've got letters from them, journals, and we've got a lot of testimonials about them, because visitors from Europe and the United States would constantly comment on these two guys they kept running into in Fiji, Whippy and Carey. And so the U.S. exploring expedition, which was sent by the U.S. government into the Pacific between 1838 and 1842, comes and meets with Carey and Whippy, and actually makes Whippy into a U.S. envoy in Fiji. And he gains quite a bit of popularity as a result of this. But their role as mediators means that they keep finding themselves accounted for in the journals and writings of everyone who shows up in Fiji to participate in the sea cucumber trade and the whale's tooth trade. And so we find them again and again and again in the writings about expeditions and travels to the Pacific.
How much of the research that you do is document-based library research, essentially, and mm-hmm. how much of it is, you know, going back to the environmental science versus traditional history division, how much of it is actually going out into the field and doing, an excavation or actual field work, environmental field work?
Mm-hmm. So as a historian, my sort of province is the archive, and I spend a lot of time working with old books, which I love. And in fact, the materials in the Nantucket Historical Association are fantastic. And I have opened up books that have, you know, everything from dried blood to dried mud from these expeditions in them. And it's fantastic to get to look at stuff that really hasn't been opened for 150 years or more. And that's super exciting. But as an environmental historian, what I'm doing is I'm sensitive to the ways that the environment is a player in these stories. Often historians aren't really thinking about the roles that ecosystems and nature play in shaping the dimensions of the tales they tell. And so instead of doing a lot of field work, what I'm doing is I'm acutely aware of and then building into my work the ways that environmental aspects form and formulate these historical episodes. Now, I would say that some of my best insights have come from places outside the archive. My book that's forthcoming is on the connections between Chile and California. And one of the best insights I got was from a taxi driver who picked me up at the Santiago airport in 2005 and was full of all sorts of conversational insights. Like at one point he said, Chileans have a way of changing the world and then disappearing. And as I thought back on this, it became kind of the epigraph for my book, because what he's really talking about is under the dictatorship in Chile from 1973 to 1990, many people were disappeared. They became the desaparecidos under the violent dictatorship. And so his comment was both a clue to me about ways of thinking of the production of invisibility, and writing that into my work was a profound insight that I didn't get from a book. I got it from a taxi driver. And so I feel like I'm always doing field work in that sense, because I'm trying to be aware of all the surroundings and my environment and the lessons that those things are teaching me, as well as what I can read in a text.
You do take your environmental history students out for a few field trips.
I do.
What do you expect them to take away from those experiences?
Well, I think I expect them to take away the sense of a tangibility to the past. One of the things I do a lot of work with my students on is the non-ocular or non-visual experience of environments, because one of the things that we think quite a bit about in my courses is the ways that the 20th century has been dominated by the visual. And when you start to read works from the 19th century, you get a sense that people were perhaps more attuned to the audial or olfactory or tactile aspects of their landscapes. And so training students how to be empathetic with the past is partly about training them how not just to see. You know, we have all these expressions in our language, seeing is believing, that truth is so associated with the visual. I see is when you're feeling enlightened, you say that. And enlightenment itself is a metaphor of illumination, light. And starting to get them to think in a non-ocular way, which helps to link them to the past, is something we do both in the field and in the classroom. And I take them often to the botanical gardens at Smith College. And we look at plants, but we also touch them and smell them and even listen to them as they're blowing in the breeze. And how do they sound? How do they, if we're allowed to, how do they taste? That's when it gets good. And to try to get beyond the ocular sense is a way to get to thinking about how people experienced the environment in the past. So this fieldwork component is, I think, crucial for doing that.
That's environmental historian Ted Melillo. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Ted Melillo. He's Associate Professor of Global Environmental History at Amherst College and author of a couple of upcoming books, one about the connections between Chile and California, and one about connections between Nantucket and the Pacific world in the 19th century. With all of the different international connections that you have studied over historical periods, when you talk to people about globalization today, this tends to be a kind of polarized topic. There are people who say globalization makes it too easy to just ignore environmental impacts of everything we do. It's, you know, really the wrong way to go. We need to go back to, you know, eat local, buy local, be local. And then there are others who say globalization spreads the wealth. It makes it possible for people who might have had incredible local environmental impacts to do something alternative that might be better. Looking at the history of the development of globalization, where do you stand on this?
That's a very good question. I think there are multiple globalizations, some of which have been remarkably beneficial and some of which I think have been extremely detrimental. And I don't think one occurs without the other. In terms of how aware we are, which is where I'd begin since I teach, I think we've become both more aware and remarkably less aware. The advent of things like click to purchase. You can go on Amazon and you click one or two buttons and a few books show up at your door 3 days later. And they may arrive by drone if Amazon is going to have its way soon, is both a remarkably wonderful thing in that we get access to information very, very quickly. But our awareness of how that information is produced, I think, has actually declined because it blinds us to all the processes and people involved in making that act possible. And so it's so easy to consume coffee in our local cafe and not think about the fact that in Ethiopia, somebody has to have grown that and perhaps it was shipped by a crew across the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean at some point. Actually, 92% of the commodities we consume in the United States cross the Pacific Ocean on a ship from China. And somebody in China was involved in spending their entire day making that pair of socks that you then buy at Walmart. And so I think we're more aware in many ways. We have access. You can Google search for just about anything and get a result. I've entered the craziest questions and gotten answers. Whether those answers are factually correct is another thing. But so we're more aware in many ways, but we're also less aware in many ways because the world has become much, much more complicated. The commodities that we consume on a daily basis are the accretion of a vast array of geographies and processes and people. And I think making people more aware of all of these spatial dislocations is really, really crucial. And it's one thing I work a lot with my students on.
Is there any generalization you can make about the kinds of environmental practices, good or bad, that colonialism imparts?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are colonial societies by the areas that are being colonized by having their autonomy superseded? Do we see a breakdown in the environment, or is there some sort of, more protective attitude that comes in from the colonial power?
I think there have been few, if you're sort of looking at this objectively, historically, few benefits to colonialism for local environments, because often what colonialism brought was the enclosure of commonly held resources and their transformation into private property. And this is one of the things that's always sort of an insight for my students. For good reason, private property has to be made. And it's often made through incredibly violent acts. And so looking at the Pacific world, which is this geographical focus of my study, in the 19th century, the Pacific really becomes this sort of apothecary, this storehouse in which colonial merchants are coming in and attempting to transform nature into saleable goods. And this really involves, for the most part, the rapacious harvest of natural resources throughout the Pacific. And you can look at whales or seals or sea otter populations or the sea cucumber. Other big ones are sandalwood, guano in the Nauru Islands off of Australia, that these things are just rapaciously harvested and sold for profit. And then in the wake of that, we've struggled to restore some of these resources. And there have been positive and uplifting success stories there. For example, Anhydrolutris, the Pacific sea otter, was just decimated in the 19th century. It went from a population of about 300,000 in the Pacific to about 3,000 over the course of the century. And there have been some really, really good recovery programs to bring the Pacific sea otter back into healthy populations. But for the most part, the stories are fairly depressing. And so there's this joke out there that environmental history can become the new dismal science pretty easily. I had one student once say to me, "Professor, are we just going to tell stories about going to hell in a handbasket for the rest of the semester?" And I thought to myself, well, unfortunately, there are going to be some of those stories. Fortunately, however, there are also tales of tremendous resilience. And one of the things that I work with my students on thinking about and I try to focus on in my research is that some of the places, some of the ecosystems especially, that we think of as kind of these pristine Edens actually are the product of tremendous human involvement in their creation over long histories. I think of Charles Mann's work in his book 1491, where he investigates the Amazon and builds on the work of many geographers. It's increasingly showing that the plant species and the spatial configurations of the Amazon rainforest are actually the product of tremendous human activity for thousands of years. And so sometimes these tales of how we've taken Eden and wantonly destroyed it are actually false as well, that they need to be rethought by historians, because we predicate this on this idea of decline. And in fact, it's a much more complicated historical tale. What I would say, though, and this is an important caveat to that point, is that we have changed the rate of change, that we're changing ecosystems at much faster rates, and these will lead to really unanticipated results that don't have historical precedent. So although we've been changing our environments for millennia, the rate of change and some of the types of change are different. And looking across a long historical span, one can really begin to get a sense of that. And I think, frankly, it's one of the important reasons that ecologists need to be in dialogue with historians, is to be able to think at different scales and then understand how types of change and rates of change have really been altered.
Yeah, I mean, we always say history will repeat itself, mm-hmm. right? History is doomed to repeat itself, especially if we don't know what it was.
Right.
Do you see in the environmental problems that we face today that these are essentially repeats or extensions of older problems? We tend to think of them as relatively new, that we've introduced new environmental issues in, mm-hmm. say, the past 30 or 50 years. Do you, from your historical perspective, see them as having a much longer history?
I think many of our present environmental problems have much longer historical roots. And people have actually, I teach a course called Environmental Issues of the 19th Century, in which we take six contemporary environmental issues, things like deforestation, soil nitrogen loss, air pollution, and try to figure out how people in the 19th century thought about these. I don't think, though, that it's a question of history necessarily repeating itself. I think, as I said, the rate of change and the types of change have been radically accelerated. And so people in the 19th century, I don't think were necessarily considering these things in apocalyptic terms, in terms of end times. I think the issues they were dealing with were perhaps more modest in some ways. And that also has to do with a lack of information that we now have at our fingertips, much more information about environmental change. But I think it's a question often of breaking some of these circuits. Yes, there are patterns of behavior that do, in fact, repeat themselves. And if we can build upon the failed precedents of the past and show that these types of behaviors were, frankly, inadequate for maintaining our sustainability, breaking those circuits may be something that history can help us usefully do.
Do you see humanity as a whole at this point in terms of relationships to the natural world? And obviously there's a huge amount of variability in there. But with all these different case studies, do you see on balance that we're on a positive trajectory or on a negative trajectory? Because it's certainly, as you said, easy to find lots of bad news.
We're on a negative trajectory. And I think there are ways that we can collectively organize to change paths and to alter that trajectory. But right now, we're using up resources, including the commons of our atmosphere, at such rapid rates that this is not a sustainable path. And that's perhaps depressing, but one of the positive, uplifting things we can do is look to the past for examples of resilient societies that have decided to take different courses of action. And one of the things I try to look at is especially states that have sort of taken out insurance policies. I think we've really radically failed to do that. But for example, the Chinese state in the late Ming and early Qing dynasties, the last two Chinese dynasties, when it was well managed, had very carefully thought about how to utilize a really diverse array of ecological profiles within about 35 degrees latitude of the space it governed. And when it was managed well, this was a very good example of a collective strategy to produce a sustainable environmental outcome. And I think there are many such examples we can draw on historically of times and places in which people had a bit more foresight than it seems we have as we sort of recklessly blunder into the future at the moment. I think we're on a negative course, but that doesn't mean we have to be. And that may be another role that historians can play in suggesting alternative possibilities.
Our political system, I think at all levels, right up to the international right now, is very focused on what we call science-based policy. But of course, policy can't just come straight out of science. It has to involve values and society. I wonder how different you think some of our policies are, would be. Can you give us an example of how you might imagine a different approach if history and social science were more incorporated into some of our policy decisions alongside, say, the climate science or the natural science that's influencing these decisions?
Well, I would hope, and I hope to do this in my teaching, to help make scientists better communicators. And I think if more scientists were also studying the humanities, that would be one major policy-making shift that would be articulated. And I would also hope that politicians would have studied science. And I think a lot of politicians and policymakers are bereft of the scientific knowledge they need to be able to really make some of these decisions. And so in my work, in both my teaching and my research, I'm trying to cross those disciplines and show the virtues of these conversations, in part because they're communicative conversations. They're conversation generators, in fact. And one of the things I try to do in all my classes is help make my students better communicators, because there is this wall still between the scientists and the public. And there's so much great science out there that's been done. And on climate change, we really know what the facts are, but the bridge hasn't yet been created in terms of the communication. And I think one of the virtues of intersections between the humanities and the sciences, and we work very hard at this at Amherst College in the Environmental Studies program, is to help make scientists better communicators, help make students who are going into policymaking better scientists. And so for me, it really is about generating new conversations and new vocabularies for being able to access the public sphere with all this knowledge that's being produced so rapidly and in such great quantities, and which has enormous virtues. So,
Ted Melillo is Associate Professor of Global Environmental History at Amherst College. Ted, thank you so much. I've learned a lot.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
This is Living Lab. Until next week, you can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.